like to welcome everybody to the Salt Lake Territory of Young Peoples of Alcoholics Anonymous speaker meeting. My name is Jonathan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jonathan.
And I'll be your chairperson for this meeting. Please silence all cell phones at this time. Okay, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer, followed by a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers inside and outside the meeting. In unison, please. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I have asked Damien to read how it works. It's kind of falling apart.
Hi, my name is Damien. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Damien.
Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. As some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us had tried to hold onto our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at a turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. When, one, we admitted we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides of progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could
and would have healed us.
Thanks, Damien. I've asked Mike to read where we came from.
My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mike.
Hi. Are bears here or what?
Yeah. Front and center.
Where we came from. Young people's groups and Alcoholics Anonymous began appearing around 1945 in Los Angeles, Cleveland, and Philadelphia, and now they can be found all across North America. In 1958, a meeting of young AAs from across the United States and Canada started what is now the International Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous, IKIPA, and it has met on an annual basis ever since. At the 1960 AA convention, Bill W. noted that the age of new members was much lower than when he and Dr. Bob founded AA 25 years earlier. In a letter to IKIPA dated June 15, 1969, Bill wrote, "In recent years, I have found nothing for greater inspiration than the knowledge that AA of tomorrow will be safe and certainly magnificent in the keeping of you who are the younger generation of the AA today."
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. We'd like to take this time and ask that any new members in their first in their first meeting or in their first 29 days of sobriety to please stand and introduce yourself by your first name. This is not to embarrass you, but this is so that we can get to know you better.
John Flint,
addict alcoholic. Hey, Flint. Welcome.
Welcome.
Any other takers? Okay. Let's see. Now, if anyone who has worked the 12 steps and is willing to sponsor, could you please stand? Awesome. If you're looking for a sponsor, see one of these people after the meeting. If you're one of those who are standing, I'd like to ask you to remember the responsibility declaration that when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there. Our first opening speaker tonight is going to be Abby D., and she's going to start off for about 15 minutes. So take it away, Abby.
Hi, my name is Abigail. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Abigail.
My sobriety date is January 28, 2012. And by the grace of God, I'm clean and sober today. I want to start out by saying that my story is kind of intense, and for a long time, I used that as something that I felt separated me from you. But what I've come to find out is that we all share the same pain. Like, no one's pain is any more or less than anyone else's, because we all got to a point of desperation that led us to this place, and it's a blessing that we're all here, clean and sober today. So, I'll touch briefly on what it was like. Childhood was, for me, starting at a young age, from about the age 4 to 7, when he passed away, my grandfather molested me. And so at a very young age, it was a outside source of validation, because it was a secret, but I was getting attention that nobody else was in that sort of a way. And I thought it was special. I thought I was unique. And he picked me, you know, not my sister. He picked me. He molested both my mom and her sister when they were younger, and I harbored some resentment that my mother let him into our house, but my mother suffers from alcoholism as well, and you know, I think that she wanted to think that something had changed. She was always looking for validation from him also. And, you know, wanted him to see that she had grown up unscathed and, you know, married this man and had this beautiful family. And I think that, so I've had to work through that issue. From very early on, I had issues with men, obviously, and I probably started using pretty heavily by 14 or 15. I was doing quite a lot of coke. But But my other issue has always been with men. So they kind of went hand in hand. It was a level of power and control. And again, it was an outside source that gave me internal gratification. By 17, I had a needle in my arm. I was dating a guy that was probably 6 or 7 years older than me. And our group of friends started doing heroin. So I started doing heroin. The basis of our relationship was using. So it was pretty unhealthy. I was waitressing, and I got fired from my job because I was carrying a tray out of the back of the house and just nodded out and dropped it all over the place. And so the option of finding another job, I had a good friend, and she worked at the strip club in town. And she had just gotten fired from that job, and one of our dope dealers thought it was a really good idea we go to Peoria and start dancing there. I had never set foot in a strip club before in my life, and we walked in, and the guy who ran it was sitting at the bar, and he stopped us before we even had to audition. He just said, "Can you girls come back tomorrow night?" And we were like, "Well, yeah, sounds great." So I did that for about 6 months. And in that environment, things that made my addiction progress even more. It's a lot of drinking, a lot of using drugs, and it got to the point where I couldn't even make it to, you know, to work the next day, because we would come back to Springfield, it was about a 45-minute drive, and spend all of our money on drugs, and it was just a vicious cycle. So we lost our jobs doing that, but I had built up a pretty good clientele of gentlemen, and they had always offered for me to come do private dances, and so I decided I would take them up on that because I needed money, because I needed to get high, and I went to do a private dance the first time, and the second time I went back to this specific gentleman's house, you know, he was like, I'll pay you, but I want you to do this much more than just dance. So I was like, okay, I'm game. And it was really easy for me to fall into that because I didn't have any self-respect, and I had gone through high school and grade school thinking that that's all I was. You know, and that attention, it was attention, and I settled for that. Whether, you know, whether that was the right type of attention, it still internally made me feel better about myself because I was getting the attention. And I'd like to sit here and glamorize it and say that, you know, I worked for escort services and I got paid lots of money to do what I did, but that's not the truth. I mean, there were great days, you know, but there were really bad days too. I was on the streets, I walked the stroll, I busted down for doves, I busted down for whatever I could to get my next high. And that's just as simple as it is. I got raped, I got beaten. I let people do unspeakable things to me, because at the end of the day, I was going to get high, and I was going to get to forget about it. My addiction took me to prison 3 times. Even inside prison, the manipulation, the scheming, the You know, I was involved with a number of the COs, and there are little girls that look like little boys in there too. So there was always that aspect of power and control and manipulating the system, manipulating people to get what I wanted. And I got really good at what I did. And I think as your disease progresses and your addictions, you get better at doing the things you do to get your drugs. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't on the streets. And this last time, where my addiction took me wasn't as bad as some of the places. I had a guy that was paying for a place for me to live, and you know, he would come over and get what he wanted, but he was paying my bills. He was keeping me high. But the shame and the guilt got to a place where I couldn't handle it anymore. I had never been a big drinker, and I picked up a bottle this last time, and it wrecked my world. It wrecked my fucking world. When I got to treatment, I was drinking a gallon and a half of vodka a day, smoking I don't know how much crack, shooting dope as often as possible, but it's pretty unattractive when you're selling your ass to have track marks. I don't really go for that, so I kind of left the needle alone. But yeah, it was the shame and the guilt that were eating me from the inside out, and it just brought me to my knees. I had always gone into prison, and I would, you know, you get that weight back on, you get looking good again, and you think about all the money you're going to make right when you get back out on the street. At least I do, because I'm going to be brand new again. There's a lot that happens, like, in crack world in 6 months. And when you show back up, you're kind of a big deal again. So I had always just, like, taken that time to, you know, to get myself back right. And then I knew I was going to go back to it. Because I'm really good at mutating myself to fit certain situations. You know, I grew up in a like upper middle class family, good family, and but I transformed like to the streets and to the ghetto and to prison so well that it was just really easy for me to get comfortable wherever I was. But like I said, going back to the shame and the guilt getting me here this last time, I was tired, and I'm almost 28, and I saw what the girls that were doing what I were doing, like what I did at 45 and 50, like that shit didn't look nothing nice, you know, to be like busting down when you're 50 years old, like, I don't know, you're definitely not, at the top of the list, and I guess you settle for a lot less, and that's just not what I didn't want the rest of my life to look like that. I think that I had gotten really comfortable, but I hadn't gotten that comfortable, and I was given the option. This last time was my sixth time in a treatment facility, and I had never, I always went in and I would like learn about myself and like pull all this pertinent information out, but I was never willing, and I wasn't willing to take anyone's suggestions because I was that rare case. I was different. I could do this shit on my own, and that just isn't the case. So when I got out here, you know, I told my parents, I was like, you're going to have to get me as far the fuck away from Springfield, Illinois as possible. And I know geographically that's not supposed to change things, you know, but for me, like, it was huge because I built that city I lived in. I built it from the ground up. And there wasn't a street corner that I turned on that I didn't know a trick, a block up the road, or a dope house, or a trap spot. I don't know what this means. Okay. So, yeah. So I got out here and I was to a place where I was willing to do whatever it took. And I wasn't even convinced that I was completely convinced I wanted to be sober. But I was convinced that I didn't want to go back to where I was. And I chose to take every suggestion that was given to me. I did 90 days in inpatient. I did a month in a transitional living. So it was like a step down program. And I did 4.5 months in a sober living. And what I did is I latched on to a group of young people that looked like they were having fun. Because I didn't even know what that looked like anymore. But these people were doing just like awesome stuff and they were loving it, you know? I jumped out of an airplane like 6 months sober. And we, you know, big groups just going out to get coffee or going out to eat at Belgium Waffle after meetings, just doing things, getting involved. Women in this program saved my life. I don't trust women. I never have. Obviously, the lifestyle that I led really instilled that because she was going to get to my money first, so fuck her. Like, and I got a sponsor because, like I said, I followed all the suggestions, and for the first time, because I can tell anybody my shit, but to tell you and think that you're going to carry part of my weight and you're going to take some of that off of me and give me some relief, like, that was new to me. And I got to do that. I got to experience trusting a woman enough to tell her everything and know she was going to hold it with me. And take some of it from me. So I worked the steps, and I worked them with a sponsor, and I stayed current with my sponsor, and I got involved with other women, amazing women. And I'll say again, women in this program have saved my life. I didn't get involved with men. I followed that suggestion. I didn't make it a year, but I made it 8 months, and that's huge for me. Because men are what validate me. Men have been the people who took care of me, and I had to learn how to take care of myself. And that's been different. I had to become responsible. I'm not sleeping with my best friend's boyfriend today. You know, I'm available as a friend. I just started sponsoring women. It's been probably the last piece of the puzzle for me because there are women that come up to me and they tell me that they want what I have. And when I got here, I didn't feel like I had anything to offer anyone. And that's been the most beautiful experience for me because I can be available today. I can be available as a friend. I can be available as a daughter, as a sister. And it's just been an amazing experience. I don't really know what else to say other than it hasn't been easy, but it's been extremely rewarding. And I finally feel like I am accepted and I'm surrounded by people that love me and really love me and take me for who I am, you know, all of me, the bad and the good. So I think that's all I've got. Thanks.
Thanks, Evan.
I'd like to turn the time now over to our main speaker, Sean M. And he's going to take out first of me.
Take it, Sean. Okay.
Get this over here. No, you're good.
I'm Sean, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Sean.
I actually can't see that.
It's fine. I'll let you.
I wear reading glasses now. I said I'm Sean and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 16th of 1980. I got sober when I was 16. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not because I woke up one morning and thought it would be a good idea. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because a judge told me that I would. I've since had the pleasure of receiving a phone call from that judge. Actually, the way the story goes is that when I graduated from graduate school, I sent him a thank you letter, and I sent him a picture of my family, and I sent him one of my chips, and told him a little bit about what had happened, and told him thanks for sending me to treatment instead of jail. And he called me, and this was 20 years later. He called me, and I learned that he was now a federal circuit court judge who was preparing to retire. And he said, thank you, because when I get it wrong, it's all over the front page. And when I get it right, people just become citizens. You know, I feel like a citizen today. I feel like a full member of my community. I participate in activities, including political activities, and get the privilege to sit at tables that I never would have imagined I would have the opportunity to sit at. And that's because that judge made that decision rather than the other decision. And I found a chair for myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous actually in 1979, so when I was 15, but I didn't have my last drink until I was 16. I'll back up and tell a little bit of the story and qualify. I also come from a nice upper middle class family. I come from a family that went to all of the parent-teacher conferences, coached soccer and coached baseball, and gave me equipment so that I could go ski. I come from a very nice, stable family. I am not someone who has suffered trauma. I am one of those folks who, once I picked up, I discovered that I loved the experience of intoxication. I loved the euphoria. It was special in a different sort of way than most of the people around me. And so those stories of tragedy and trauma that bring individuals to Alcoholics Anonymous, and stories like mine, is an example of the breadth and depth of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can find it all here, sometimes good and sometimes bad, but you can certainly find it all here. If you think you qualify, you qualify. So alcohol was it, but I could never control alcohol. I was one of those folks who was always drinking too much. I am one of those folks whose tolerance was way too high for somebody who was as young as I was and inexperienced as I was. I did things while under the influence that were out of the chute. Troubling to me and to everyone, but alcohol and the experience of intoxication was so powerful that I kept going back to it. The only thing that I really did to try and control my drinking was smoke more pot. And that wasn't very effective. And you can imagine why. But nevertheless, those two went hand in hand with me. What got me to Alcoholics Anonymous was I stole the car for the second time. The first time was a dramatic expression because my mom or my dad, it was probably my dad, had tried to discipline me in some way. And so I ran away and stole the car, and a lot of drama. And all he was trying to do was help me at the time. I'm sure. But this was the second time, and I had this buddy who I would smoke pot and smoke cigarettes with out behind the schoolhouse, and I said, Harlan, would you ever steal another car? And Harlan was, we were both 13, 14. I said, Harlan, would you ever steal another car? Well, Harlan was this guy who had been stealing cars since he was like six. And he, the reason he stole cars is because he liked to drive cars. So he'd steal cars and drive cars and get caught. And, you know, and he had been on probation, juvenile probation since he was like nine. And I said, Harlan, would you ever steal another car? And he says, well, yeah, I probably would if I were a long way from home and didn't have any way to get there. Okay? So it is, it's the senior kegs, 1979. Senior kegs, 1979. 1979, I'm not a senior. I'm in middle school. Okay? And I'm partying with the seniors because they drank like I did. Or at least sort of like I did. I was a long ways from, and got too drunk again. When I get too drunk, the way I control it is I leave. And the reason that I leave is because I know that I'm going to pass out, and I know that when I pass out, I'm going to piss myself. You know? That's the way it was, you know? And that's shameful for a 15-year-old boy. And so a 15-year-old boy isn't going to want to be around other people with pissed pants. And so I would hitchhike home. And so I was having a very difficult time walking backward, hitchhiking in the dark. That conversation with Harlan occurred to me. And it made complete sense. It was the most rational decision I could have made in the moment. By the grace of God, the first car that I went to, the door was unlocked and the keys were in the ignition. What? No shit. Yeah. The way I look at that today is God was looking out for me, you know, because that was the tool that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had said to myself, I'm going to get this car out of this driveway, and I am going to take this car to a hollow. I lived in Rapid City, South Dakota, and up in the Black Hills, we have hollers, or, you know, if you're from Kentucky, you know what I'm talking about. So we have those two, I was going to park the car in the hollow, and I was going to wipe it down, and I was going to walk away from it, but it was so easy, and I was having so much fun that I decided to change my plan, and I decided that what I was going to do is go cruise 8th Street in my stolen car. State Street is like 8th Street is like State Street, where I'm from, and I, of course, didn't use my blinker to change lanes. I had no idea what the officer was talking about. She pulled me over and she asked me for my license and registration. Well, I'm 15. I don't have a license and it's not my car. So I, of course, spent the night in jail. That was not a good night in jail. I was particularly intoxicated. They initially put me, Rapid City, South Dakota does not have a juvenile detention facility, so you got the cell that you got. And if you were in with an adult, you were in with an adult. And so they put me in with this guy. Well, I actually didn't know that they put me in this cell with the guy because I'm kind of browning in and out. I saunter up to what I think is the toilet and start taking a piss, and it's this guy's bed, and he's very upset. That's what I drink like. You know, that's the story. And it just goes on and on and on. So I end up before this juvenile court judge, and this juvenile court judge says, Mr. McMillan, would you like to say a few words before I sentenced you? And I said yes. I told the truth. I said I stole the car because I was too drunk to walk. you know? Everybody said, whoa, wait a minute, because they had actually intended to send me to the state juvenile facility, and I was, what I learned later is that I was going to be there until I was 18 because I had enough of a record to justify that. They're not called prosecutors in juvenile court, but it was essentially the prosecutor. They say, whoa, wait a minute. We want to get a drug and alcohol assessment done. And another funny thing, so the guy that they send me to do the assessment is this guy named Norris Engelbritzen. Well, the party that I was at that night was at his house. He had been out of town. His mom and dad were out of town. They're not Norris's, but their kids were the ones who were hosting the party, but it was being hosted at his house. So a little bit of irony. Norris says to me, yeah, you definitely got a problem, but you'd probably do as well as in an outpatient program as is in an inpatient program. So I'm going to recommend to the judge that you go to the outpatient program here at Rapid City Regional. And I say, cool, because I drink and smoke dope on the weekends with most of those folks. And so I knew that wasn't going to be too grueling. So I get back to court, and they say, no, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to send you to the state hospital to the adolescent unit. And that's where I go to treatment. It was everything that you imagine about a state hospital in a rural state, you know. That's what it was, man. Everything that you can imagine about that in 1979, that's what it was like. But I also go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy named Jim gets up and speaks. And Jim was missing an eye, and he had lost an arm. And he tells the story of losing his eye and losing his arm, and that story has to do with cars and trains and alcohol, and it also includes his wife and daughter getting killed. Okay, other than the age and some of the circumstance, this old man told my story in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, he talked about hopping trains. He talked about love and drinking. He talked about how he had affected his family. He talked about being involved with the law. This old man told my story, you know. And by the grace of God, I was able to see through his face or his appearance. To the story that he was telling. I love our stories, man. Our stories have the power to produce miracles as far as I'm concerned. You know? Not every time, you know, but they have incredible power as far as I'm concerned. The power to produce miracles. I'm not recognizing any of that as a miracle, but I was intrigued, you know. This guy has got a story that is my story, and he's suffered a loss that I could not imagine. I had not even ever pondered that kind of a tragedy. To give you a sense about how much I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember a reference from a MASH episode where they're telling this story about how this guy is inspired to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because he saw an American Airlines plane fly by. That was the extent of what I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never heard the term before in my life. I knew nothing about it. Okay? And this was before I had sobered up. That's all I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm intrigued by this story that Jim tells, and I had something happen with a guy before when I was in a halfway house before I was transported. to the state hospital, and this guy, you know, just says, you know, Sean, your life's a fucking mess, you know. Your life is broken. The way you are doing it is getting you here, you know, and you are 15, you know. Pay attention. Try and let what is about to happen be an opportunity rather than a sentence. And I was sufficiently open. I was sufficiently open-minded, sufficiently receptive, whatever you want to say, to that real simple message. You know, the guy spoke the truth, and he encouraged me to do something that might have the power to change my life. I didn't know that at the time, but you know, I was open to it, and it just kept happening. I just kept hearing these, trusting these people who I didn't know, and I was doing this naturally, not because I had worked the steps. I know I was 15 minutes sober, you know. But I'm hearing the stuff that I need to hear. I'm hearing this really powerful message that is sufficiently intriguing that it keeps me engaged. I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as I'm preparing my fourth step, like you used to do in treatment all the time, and you know, I'm talking to these guys about how afraid I am of the things that I'm going to discover as I do my fourth step, and these guys share with me, you know what, Sean, our experience is that the monster that you think you are is not the monster that you are once you get it on paper. And I found that to be true, that I'm not a monster. I believed I was a monster because of the things that I did or would do so that I could know the euphoria of intoxication. And I did not have a good experience with my first fifth step. The first fifth step, I thought it was really privileged because they had told me I should feel privileged because it was an Episcopal bishop that was hearing my fifth step, but it was really pretty vacant, you know. He just kind of did this blessing thing and really didn't hear much of the story, and it didn't have much meaning to me, you know. It really didn't. And, you know, and back then, sharing a fifth step with clergy was something that you did, you know, that was how you often did it. But it was not a significant experience to me. After I got out of that treatment center, I was sent to a halfway house in another town, in another part of South Dakota, and met the right guys again, guy named Wayne and Toad. And they were banditos. For those of you who don't know what the banditos are, it's a motorcycle club. They sometimes compete with other motorcycle gangs for different things. That's what I aspired to when I was doing my thing. I aspired to prospect the banditos. That was the ultimate goal. If I could get into the banditos, I would have made it. And so here I'm in Watertown, South Dakota, and Wayne and Toad, who are two hardcore Harley riders, are coming to meetings and enthusiastic about sobriety and enthusiastic about recovery. The perfect couple of guys for me. Because this was boring, okay? Mm-hmm. There was not a lot to do. And back in you know, 79, 80, there weren't rooms like this. It was men who were over 40, always over 40, and often over 50, and often into their 60s, you know? And they were good and generous men, don't get me wrong. And there were a few women. But especially in rural, relatively rural South Dakota, Now, I was not excited about a life sober, but I also knew that I was in the right place and that I at least needed to do this to get the judge off my back. And so continued to remain engaged and went through and did the steps again and met this other guy named Mike, who was first generation off the boat from Ireland, and he was a really, really good man to me. Mike tells this really powerful story that illustrated how important Alcoholics Anonymous was to him. Mike was dyslexic, and this was before dyslexia was diagnosed with any frequency, and so he never learned how to read. He just never learned how to read. And so he gets to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know how literature heavy we are. We're always talking about the book and saying this about the steps and all of that. And he's ashamed, of course, to let anybody know that he doesn't know how to read. And so he'll go to the book meeting and he'll pass to read, but he'll listen to people read. Okay? He's not saying anything to anybody. And then what he's doing is he's going home and he's having his 10-year-old daughter read to him out of the book. And that's how he learned how to read. I ran into some guys when I was in Minneapolis at the World Convention back in 2002 or 2000 or 2005. I don't remember which one it was. And it was 2000. No, I don't remember. I asked about him, and he says, yeah, he's still around. He's not going to a lot of meetings. And this guy's got to be, 50 years sober now, or at least approaching 50 years sober. That meant a lot to me, because what it impressed upon me was this was a man who saw himself as a desperate alcoholic, so desperate that he would humble himself before his daughter. His 10-year-old daughter, and say, teach me how to read, because I believe this will save my life. That's powerful stuff. I can understand that kind of desperation. I also have just an incredibly deep appreciation for that kind of willingness. That's just profound humility, I'm still hooked. I'm still doing the thing, and I'm one of those folks who I think it was a factor of youth and relative health that I didn't suffer much as far as detox was concerned or withdrawal. Some of you may have gone to Clancy the other day, and he talked about it's not the quitting, it's the staying quit. It's that after I haven't drank for a few weeks or a few months or a few years, that feeling that I get in my gut that tells me that I have to drink and that will be the only relief I will ever know. I'm one of those guys, I'm one of those guys who's a real alcoholic. I know what it is to suffer obsession. I know what it is to suffer compulsion. And by the way, when you hear somebody say real alcoholic, that's actually what they mean, is I am someone who has known the obsession. I am someone who has known the compulsion. To give you an example of what I mean by that, I couldn't steal any more booze from my dad one Friday or Saturday night because I had stolen too much. I had smoked all of my dope. I had scraped all of the resin. I had smoked all the stems and seeds I had. When I was 11, 12 years old, I had a summer of huffing different products, and I knew that I would get some relief. I knew that it would make me sick, but I knew that I would get some relief from the discomfort that I was experiencing. That's compulsion, That's obsession, and that's compulsion, at least for me. Working the steps and remaining engaged, this guy named Kurt Baymiller, who was one of those guys in Yankton, his son lived in Watertown. I would use use Kurt as a sponsor. And Kurt would, because now I'm, you know, 9-10 months sober, and now I'm starting to feel the discomfort of abstinence, you know. And I'm, you know, I get relief when I talk to other alcoholics. I get relief when I go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get relief when I am of service to others. You know, but there are times in the middle, you know, that, and you got to just pick up that fucking phone and talk to somebody who might understand. And so I would call Kurt. And Kurt would just listen to me, and he would say, Sean, you know, I don't know when it's going to get better, but I promise that it will. You know, and I would call him again a couple of weeks later, and he'd say, Sean, I don't know when it's going to get better, but I can promise that it will. You know, you just got to remain vigilant. You got to do the work. You got to do step stuff. And, you know, and so I would do what he said, you know, and just go on and just trust. Just trust that this guy wasn't lying to me. You know, and he wasn't. Well, I got 5 minutes.
You got 15.
No, really?
Yeah.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Cool. and so, I'm continuing to do it. I'm going to a step study meeting, or trying to go to a step study meeting. This is all just incredibly mysterious. What do you mean powerlessness? What do you mean surrender? What do you mean turn my life and will over to the care of God? What do you mean make a man? It was a jumble. It was a mess. It was confusing. It was mysterious, and all of those things. And so I complete the portion of my sentence that is halfway house. And I'm moving back. I moved back to Rapid City, which is where I was from and where I had done all of my running and gunning. And I get this probation officer named Dudley LaPointe. I love that name. and he was a great guy. He was intrigued by me because I was doing the deal. I was doing the meetings thing. And his kid smoked pot like a fiend. And he had helped his, he had, you know, done everything that he could imagine as a father and as a law enforcement officer to help his kid, and just nothing was working. And, you know, and he was just so intrigued, you know, and he paid me the honor of asking me to take his kid to a meeting. His kid didn't stay, but, you know, that was the kind of relationship I had with my probation officer. You know, he was a good guy, you know, and he supported me, and it gets to the end of my term of probation, and he says, you want your record expunged, you know, and I got no idea what record expunged means, and I say, yeah, sure, and so he expunged my record. That's a big friggin' deal, you know, that is a big deal, and, you know, so it's just cool stuff like that. So I'm back, and I'm one of those guys who really likes a clear, concise message. You know, I'm drawn to folks in the rooms who speak well about our principles, about our traditions. You know, so the guy that I asked to be my sponsor is this guy named J.D. McKenna, and J.D. has since passed away. But he was the first guy formally asked to be my sponsor, and J.D. J.D. was a cowboy, a real cowboy. He earned his buckle. He was actually a world rodeo champion in the day. And he had a wife who was a Vogue model, real deal Vogue model, back in the 30s. That's who they were, you know. They were a very attractive couple. And J.D. spoke incredibly well. Dee, his wife, was hardcore Al-Anon, like hardcore Al-Anon. She's the kind of woman to say, Sean, you know why God invented the phone? And I'd say, no, Dee, why did God invent the phone? And she'd say, so that one alcoholic can call another. Do you understand? No? And I would say, yes. to this lady, you said, yes, ma'am. You know? Yes, ma'am. And so I start reading the book with, well, JD says, I want you to come over after school, because I'm still in high school. And JD says, I want you to come over after school, you know, every day, and we will read the book. So I come over to his house every day after school to read the book, and he's never there. And guess who I have to sit down and read the book with?
D.
D. It was tough, man. It was really tough. Because, you know, she had lived the life of an alcoholic. And JD was the kind of guy I learned later. He opened a casino in Sheridan, Wyoming. There isn't gambling in Wyoming. Okay. Okay. But he opened a casino. He shot it out with the sheriff over that, you know, and that's who this guy was, okay? And you just didn't argue with him. You said, yes, sir. Same with her. Yes, sir. No, sir. You know, yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. You know, he would say, so what's the yeah buts, you know? You see yourself, are you reading between the lines, or are you just reading the words as they are on the page? You know, read the words as they are on the page. Quit finding the exception. Does most of this resonate? That wasn't a word that JD would use, but does most of this resonate for you? Can you see yourself here? And he would say, you don't have to see everything, but do you see enough of yourself that you identify? And I said, yeah. Couple little more stories about JD that are significant to me is one is I forgot one of them, but here's the other one. That's where it is. So I qualify myself as an alcoholic. I don't say addict alcoholic. I don't say alcoholic addict. I don't say dually dependent, chemically dependent. I don't do that stuff. And it's not because some old timer. Well, that's not, some old timer did say something to me, and many old timers have said something to me about it. But the truth is, I didn't care about them. What I cared about was something that JD said to me, and this was during one of our reading sessions, and we were reading the chapter of the doctor's opinion, and we were going to the thing in the back where it's talking about the American Medical Association, you know, and they're saying yes, it is a disease, and. He said, that is why we call ourselves alcoholics, you know, because what is described here is the cause and the course of a disease, and the American Medical Association and you know has said that it is, and they said that it's alcoholism, and for him. Alcoholism was just the name for the disease. He knew that it meant other, JD, knew that it meant other things, but that was what they called the disease at the time, or at least in his mind, okay? And so that's why I qualify myself as an alcoholic, and I don't do other things, and because for me, that's the name of the disease. And he said, Sean, if this was back in 81, he said, if we had put a name on it today, yes, it would have probably been called drug addiction or addictive disease, but it's not, you know. And so that's why I qualify myself as an alcoholic and not other things. And then another thing that he did to me was, and it's related to this, is so, you know, I'm doing that whole dance. So this is what precipitated that. So I'm doing the alcoholic addict, alcoholic, and dually dependent, chemically dependent. And he comes up to me after the meeting and he says, so what are you, boy? And, and I say, what do you mean? He said, he says, have you ever read the chapter more about alcoholism? And I said, yeah, which was a lie. And so I ran home and read it. And then I went over to his house, and that's where he gives me the lecture about, you know, all of this, because he knew I was lying. You know. So I got 10 minutes probably.
Yeah.
So um, One and two were pretty easy for me. And the reason that one and two were pretty easy for me is that my life was out of control. It was a chocolate mess. You know, I had been adjudicated a juvenile delinquent. My parents' parental rights had been terminated. I was a ward of the state. You know, I am not in control of anything. And the reason I am not in control of anything is because of alcohol. Okay, it's pretty easy to get that my life is unmanageable. All of that stuff involved an extreme degree of craziness, insanity, you know, and just bizarre and crazy things, you know. And so it's pretty easy to get my head around, you know, God restoring me to sanity. That sets me up pretty nicely for three as far as I'm concerned, you know. What I had been doing weren't working, you know. My life was broke. I got me to a treatment center, you know. That was my best work. And what I had found at that treatment center is people who were speaking truth as far as I was concerned. And what three was about was simply trusting somebody other than me to give me some guidance. How I have come to understand that today is that exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I am concerned, is an incredible gift. If you have had the opportunity to be exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, you have been exposed to a powerful gift, whether you choose to stay or not. Because I work in the substance abuse treatment industry, I know how many people suffer this. And I mean suffer this, you know. If you're exposed and you choose to stay, and I believe it is a choice to stay, you will be handed an incredible gift that, as far as I'm concerned, I will never be able to repay, you know. I continue to attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, so on and so forth. Four and five were really pretty easy for me because I'm so narcissistic. I love writing about myself and I love talking about myself. You know, and all that kind of stuff. It was actually six and seven that horrified me. And the reason that six and seven horrified me was they were about being willing to be empty. Mm. You know, being willing to be empty. And that's what I believed that I would be if I were truly sincere with six and seven. Because I certainly had a lot of character defects and not many character assets as far as I was concerned. And what I feared is that if I was sincere in those steps, that God would leave me empty. That was not my experience. That was just my fear. I did those steps to the best of my ability. Not all of my character defects were removed. I came to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time for the wrong reason, you know. And I'll talk about that at the end. What I found in seven was that God will remove from me only those defects of character which no longer serve him. Okay, eight and nine were tough, of course, but I was by that time willing to trust. And 10 is about, you know, all of the good men who contributed to the development of all of our steps, and they are not new ideas, they are ancient ideas, knowing that we would screw up, and I have screwed up plenty, you know, That's the mechanism that I'm compelled to use to correct that, to fix that, those mistakes. It gives me instruction. 11 is embodied, as far as I'm concerned, in St. Francis's prayer. That's what it's about. You know, is Lord, make me a channel of Thy peace, that where there is hatred, might I bring love. And that's actually one of the tools that I use when I get disturbed. 12 is about service, and generally it's about service to others as far as I'm concerned. I'm not one of those people who suffered a a spiritual experience, suffered a spiritual experience. I did not suffer a spiritual experience. I had a spiritual awakening. And to give you an example of what I mean, what I'm talking about is Rice-Eccles Stadium used to have a tunnel at the north end. And so I'm driving through that one spring day, and I'm coming out on the other side, and there's fresh snow on Mount Olympus, and it's sunny and a little bit cloudy, and it's magnificent. It's absolutely beautiful. It's stunning. And I'm 7 years sober, and I get this thought pops into my head, wow, you've gone for a couple of days without thinking about drinking or using. You know, I'm one of those folks for whom the ever-present thought was the ever-present thought. For like the first 7 years, I was sober. And I was, you know, driving underneath, coming out and seeing these beautiful mountains and thinking, wow, you've gone a couple of days and you haven't thought about drinking or using. That I do not consider a curse any longer. It felt heavy at the time, but how I viewed it, how I view it today is that it was that ever-present reminder, and this was the counsel I got from my sponsor, is that, Sean, it's just the ever-present reminder that you really are in the right place, you know? Because somebody without a drinking problem doesn't think about drinking all the time, you know? that's a lot of truth in a few words. I am one of those folks who was also very afraid to be out in the world. And found a community here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and found most of my jobs, found most of my girlfriends, found, as far as I'm concerned, everything that I needed for a long time. I got involved, at the group level, but wasn't satisfied, and met this guy named Bruce shortly after I moved here in 83, and Bruce had sobered up in 79, 79, 80, something like that, and had been to the Icky Paw in Minneapolis in 80. And he said, Sean, we got to do it here. Bruce has since moved on. He lives up in Seattle with his wife and kids, and his life's great. So we formed this group, and we went to the Icky Paw in Denver in 85, and that got us all pumped up, and we came back here and started the UC Paw and did that whole deal. And number of things happened. One is, you know, I talked about, you know, I didn't get outside of the world of Alcoholics Anonymous for a lot of years, people. You know, everything in my world was this. You know, centered around this, it was actually the responsibilities that I took on as a committee member that got me out in the world. You know, that helped me to build confidence, a sense of competence as a man in the world, because I was doing something for Alcoholics Anonymous, so I felt a deep passion about it. And most people out in the world respect people who have deep passion, as long as they're not zealots. and so just kept encountering people out in the world who received me well, who were not part of our club. And I learned that the world was a much more welcoming place to someone like me than I had initially believed, or to tell you the truth, secretly believed. But then I also started to know the incredible satisfaction that goes with being part of something that becomes a stable young people's meeting, being part of something that becomes a committee, being part of something that becomes a conference, being something that becomes part of a national conference. Having the privilege of serving on the Icky Paw Advisory Council and being in a room with 5,000 people in New York City in the Marriott Marquis, and the chandeliers are going crazy. You know, because we're rocking the room, man. You know, we are just rocking the fucking room. And, there have been more than one occasion where that has brought me to tears, you know, to be part of that. One of my favorite stories in the back of the book is he sold himself short. There's a passage in there where he talks about watching something small turn into something great. And I feel like I've known that privilege. You know, and that comes by honoring my service commitments. You know, I believe that that is the product of it. I've been married for 22 years this year. I got a 19-year-old daughter who is down in Ecuador doing humanitarian work. As part of a gap year, I've got another daughter who is a junior at West in the IB program and just kicking it. They love to come to our parties, you know. Mm-hmm. They love to come to our grown-up parties, too, you know, grown-up AA parties, you know, because they like the people, because we're good people, you know. I'm just thrilled by that. Just thrills me beyond belief. I've been in the same field for 25 years. I have a couple of degrees from the University of Utah. I've participated in the development of legislation that has become law. I've been to DC and done stuff and things that I would have never imagined doing out in the world. But that foundation was here. The last thing I want to talk about, and I'm sure I'm over, I actually am, for 6 minutes, and I apologize. I'm a man who grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I talk about coming to meetings for the wrong reason, I was coming to meetings for a long time chasing skirt. part of that is, yeah, it kept me coming back to meetings. The other part of that, though, is that I did harm, real harm. There are young women who came to Alcoholics Anonymous looking for sanctuary, and they found me. Alcoholics Anonymous was not a safe place because they found me rather than the women of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm talking about this because it's the only amend that I know how to make. When you ask me to be your sponsor, one of the conversations that we have is about how we as young men behave in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. As far as I'm concerned, it is our responsibility to serve as protectors. And when we as young men behave badly, it is our responsibility to do something about that. Now, I'm not talking about raising our voices, or I'm talking about modeling good behavior. You know, and you know what I mean. These women were never able to make it back. You know, that is real harm that I can, the only way that I know to make amend for is to speak about it as I'm speaking about it now. So with that, I'll close. Thank you. Woo!